A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been hanging around some ADHD support communities online, and he noticed something that's been bugging him. A lot of these spaces seem to operate on the assumption that they're talking to parents. Parents looking for advice about their kids. And when adults with ADHD show up, there's this weird undercurrent, sometimes explicit, sometimes not, that kids mostly outgrow it, that this is a childhood condition that fades. Daniel got diagnosed in his 30s, so he's never known ADHD as anything but an adult reality. Calendars, time management, keeping a household running. He's asking what the data actually says. Is ADHD a children's condition that some people happen to carry into adulthood, or is that framing just wrong?
Oh, this is a good one, and Daniel's frustration makes total sense when you look at what the research has actually been telling us for decades now. Let me start with the core number that reframes the whole conversation. The big longitudinal studies, particularly the multimodal treatment of ADHD study, the MTA, which followed hundreds of kids starting in the 90s, they found that about 60% of children diagnosed with ADHD still meet full diagnostic criteria as adults. That's not a minority who hang on to it. That's most of them.
60% is way higher than the cultural assumption. The cultural assumption feels more like 20%, maybe 30. The, oh, he'll grow out of it crowd.
And even that 60% number understates things, because a huge chunk of the remaining 40% don't exactly become neurotypical. They might fall below the full diagnostic threshold, so they technically don't have ADHD anymore by DSM criteria. But they still show significant functional impairment. Trouble at work, relationship difficulties, executive function struggles. Russell Barkley, who's been one of the leading researchers in this space for decades, has argued that by the time you're looking at functional impairment rather than just symptom checklists, the persistence rate is closer to 80 or 90%.
The framing is almost inverted. The question isn't, do kids outgrow ADHD? The question is, do a small number of kids experience enough neural maturation to no longer be meaningfully impaired? And the answer is yes, a minority do. But the default trajectory is persistence.
And here's where the data gets even more interesting. There was a major study published a few years back in the American Journal of Psychiatry. It followed over 500 children diagnosed with ADHD, with assessments at multiple points all the way into adulthood. What they found was that when you check in at different ages, a lot of people who appeared to have outgrown ADHD in their early 20s actually had symptoms reemerge later. The condition waxes and wanes. Someone might look fine at 23 when they're in a structured environment and their prefrontal cortex has just finished developing, and then crash hard at 30 when they have a job with open-ended deadlines and a couple of kids.
That tracks with what Daniel's describing, right? He got diagnosed in his 30s. That's not an unusual story at all. It's practically the archetype.
It is the archetype. And the reason is exactly what you just pointed to, environmental scaffolding. A lot of people with ADHD, especially the inattentive subtype, can compensate remarkably well when they have external structure. School provides that. Parents provide that. A first job with a manager who checks in daily provides that. Then you hit a phase of life where the scaffolding disappears and you're expected to generate your own structure from within, which is precisely what the ADHD brain struggles with. That's when people who were never diagnosed as kids suddenly hit a wall and seek assessment.
Let's talk about the online community thing Daniel raised, because that's the texture of his question. Why do these spaces default to the parent of a child framing?
I think there are a few things going on. One is just historical momentum. ADHD entered public consciousness as a childhood disorder. The hyperactive little boy who can't sit still in class, that was the face of ADHD for decades. The DSM criteria themselves were written around childhood presentations until relatively recently. It wasn't until the DSM-5 in 2013 that the diagnostic criteria were adjusted to include adult-specific examples. Before that, you had to meet criteria designed for children, which meant things like runs about or climbs excessively in situations where it is inappropriate, not exactly how a 40-year-old accountant experiences their executive dysfunction.
The 40-year-old accountant is not climbing the furniture. They're missing mortgage payments because the bill is sitting on the counter, and their brain has decided it's invisible.
Which is every bit as impairing, just less visible to a teacher. And that points to the second reason these communities tilt toward parents. The most visible, most disruptive presentations of ADH happen in childhood, and they happen in settings where there's an adult, a parent or a teacher, who is motivated to seek help. A child who is failing classes or getting suspended generates intervention. An adult who is underperforming at work and feels like they're constantly drowning just internalizes it as a personal failure. They don't necessarily think, I should join an ADHD support community. They think, I need to try harder.
Which is also why the late diagnosis experience is so emotionally complicated. You spend decades building an identity around the idea that you're lazy or scattered or not living up to your potential. Then you get a diagnosis and realize there was a neurological explanation the whole time. There's relief, but there's also grief.
And that's a dimension that parent-focused communities often miss entirely, the grief piece. The recontextualizing of your entire life history through a diagnostic lens. When a parent joins a community asking about their 8-year-old, the conversation is forward-looking. Medication options, IEP meetings, behavioral strategies. When an adult joins, they're often processing backward. They're looking at their failed relationships and their academic struggles and their spotty employment history and trying to make sense of it all. Those are fundamentally different conversations, and when a community is structured around the first one, the second one can feel pretty alienating.
Let's get into the neurobiology for a minute, because I think this is where the outgrowing it myth really falls apart. What's actually happening in the brain?
This is where the imaging research is genuinely fascinating. We've known for a while that ADHD is associated with delayed cortical maturation. The prefrontal cortex, which handles executive functions like planning, impulse control, and working memory, develops more slowly in kids with ADH. It reaches peak thickness later, sometimes by several years. And for a long time, people interpreted that as, they're just behind, they'll catch up. But the more granular research shows that's not quite right. The developmental trajectory is different, not just delayed. Some regions do catch up structurally, but functional connectivity patterns, how different brain regions talk to each other, remain distinct into adulthood.
The architecture is different, not just the timeline.
And there's a specific finding I want to highlight because it's so telling. Researchers have looked at the default mode network, which is the brain system that's active when you're not focused on an external task, mind-wandering, self-referential thought. In neurotypical brains, when you engage in a task that requires attention, the default mode network quiets down. In ADHD brains, it doesn't suppress as effectively. That's why someone with ADHD can be trying to focus on a spreadsheet, and their brain keeps serving up thoughts about what they should have said in an argument 3 years ago. The task positive network and the default mode network are basically fighting for bandwidth.
That's such a better explanation than they're not trying hard enough. And it's a structural difference, not a phase.
That's the key point. The functional connectivity patterns that characterize ADHD are present in adults, including adults who were never treated. It doesn't just vanish when you turn 18.
Daniel's prompt mentions that he thinks about ADHD in purely adult terms now. Calendar management, time blindness, all of that. Is there data on what the biggest functional impacts actually are for adults?
There's quite a lot, actually. Employment outcomes are a big one. Adults with ADHD are significantly more likely to be underemployed relative to their education level. They change jobs more frequently. They're more likely to be fired or disciplined for performance issues. And the income gap is substantial. Some studies have estimated that adults with ADHD earn somewhere between 15 and 25% less than their peers, controlling for education.
That's a real material consequence. That's not, oh, I'm a little scattered sometimes.
It's not. And then there's the relationship dimension. Divorce rates are higher. Parenting. Here's an interesting loop. Adults with ADHD. D who have children with ADHD face a compounding challenge. They're trying to provide structure for a child while struggling to generate structure for themselves. The emotional dysregulation piece, which doesn't get enough attention in my view, strains partnerships. Impulsive comments, difficulty managing frustration, the tendency to zone out during conversations. Over time, partners can interpret these as lack of caring rather than neurological symptoms.
Which brings us back to the community question. If you're an adult with ADHD, and you're navigating a marriage that's under strain or a career that's stalling out, and you walk into a support space where the dominant conversation is, "How do I get my son to remember his homework?" You're not going to feel seen.
You're not. And here's a dynamic I think Daniel is picking up on that goes even deeper. There's a subtle version of the outgrowing it myth that shows up in how parents in these communities talk about their kids' futures. They'll say things like, "I just want to get him through school, and then he'll be fine." Or, "Once her brain matures, she'll have an easier time." And it's well-intentioned, but it sets up an expectation that ADHD has an expiration date, which then makes the adult who is still struggling feel like something went wrong, like they're the exception who failed to outgrow it, when actually they're the norm.
I want to pull on a thread you mentioned earlier, the DSM criteria. You said they were updated in 2013 to include adult examples. What did that actually change in terms of diagnosis rates?
It made a measurable difference. Before DSM-5, the diagnostic threshold for adults was murky. You had to retrospectively establish that symptoms were present before age 7, which was hard to do if you were 45 and your parents weren't around or didn't remember. DS. M5 moved the age of onset requirement to 12, which is more realistic, and added examples like often loses things necessary for tasks, keys, wallet, phone, alongside the childhood examples about toys and school supplies. It also lowered the symptom threshold for adults from 6 to 5 in either the inattentive or hyperactive impulsive domain.
It acknowledged that the presentation changes, but the underlying condition doesn't.
And the result was that a lot of adults who had been flying under the radar finally met criteria. There was a notable uptick in adult diagnoses after 2013, not because ADHD suddenly became more common, but because the diagnostic framework finally caught up to what the longitudinal research had been saying all along.
Let's talk about the prevalence numbers overall, because this is another place where the children versus adults framing gets messy. What do the actual epidemiological studies show?
The global prevalence of ADHD in children is typically estimated around 5-7%. In adults, the estimates have varied more, but the most recent meta-analyses put it around 2.5-4%. Now, at first glance, that looks like a drop-off, which is what the outgrowing it can't point to. But the issue is that most prevalence studies in adults rely on different methodologies than childhood studies. They often use screening tools that are less sensitive to adult presentations. And critically, they miss the people who were never diagnosed as children, which is a huge portion of the adult ADHD population.
The apparent drop-off might be partly an artifact of how we measure.
That's the strong suspicion among researchers. When you do longitudinal studies, following the same people from childhood to adulthood, you get persistence rates like the 60% I mentioned. Cross-sectional prevalence studies that sample different populations at different ages are going to undercount adults because so many of them were never identified in the first place. The diagnostic infrastructure for adults just isn't as developed.
Which loops back to Daniel's community observation. If the diagnostic infrastructure for adults is weaker, it makes sense that the support infrastructure would be weaker too. The parent-focused communities are reflecting where the clinical attention has historically been directed.
And that's starting to shift, but slowly. There's been a surge in adult ADH. HD awareness in the last few years, partly driven by social media, for better and worse, and it's changing the composition of these communities. But the institutional memory, the default framing, still tilts heavily toward parents.
What about the medication question? Because I think this is another place where the children's condition framing has real consequences. If you believe ADHD is something most kids outgrow, then medicating a child feels like a temporary intervention to get them through school. If you understand it as a chronic condition, the calculus changes.
This is a really important point. Stimulant medication, methylphenidate, amphetamine-based medications, these are among the most effective treatments in all of psychiatry. Effect sizes are large, often in the 0.8 to 1.2 range, but the treatment patterns show a steep drop-off in late adolescence. A lot of kids stop taking medication around 17 or 18, often because they're transitioning from pediatric to adult care, and they fall through the cracks, or because they've internalized the idea that they should be done with ADH. By now,
then what happens? Then what happens?
Then the impairments compound. Academic performance drops in college. Job performance suffers. Risk of substance abuse goes up. And this is counterintuitive for a lot of people, because they worry about stimulant medication leading to substance abuse, but the data actually shows that untreated ADHDH is associated with higher rates of substance use disorders, and appropriate medication treatment reduces that risk. Driving accidents increase. Unplanned pregnancies increase. The list goes on.
They'll outgrow it. Assumption isn't just factually wrong. It's actively harmful. It leads to treatment discontinuation at exactly the moment when the scaffolding is disappearing and the demands are increasing.
That's the tragedy of it. You have a young adult whose brain is still developing. Prefrontal maturation continues into the mid-20s, and they're entering the least structured phase of their life, and we're taking away the treatment that was helping them function. It's like removing someone's glasses and then being surprised they keep walking into walls.
All right, let me play devil's advocate for a second, because I think there's a version of the counterargument that deserves a fair hearing. Some people do seem to experience a meaningful reduction in symptoms as they age. There are adults who were diagnosed as kids, took medication through school, and then as adults found they didn't need it anymore, or needed it much less. Is that just the minority we already acknowledged, or is there something more nuanced going on?
There's something more nuanced, and I want to be careful here because I don't want to overstate the persistence case in a way that takes hope away from people. Some individuals do show significant symptom reduction. The brain does mature, and for some people, that maturation closes the gap enough that they can function without clinical support. But what the research suggests is that this is more about developing compensatory strategies and choosing environments that fit their cognitive profile than it is about the underlying neurology normalizing.
It's not that the ADHD went away, it's that they built a life that accommodates it.
Someone with ADH. D, who becomes a freelance photographer with a flexible schedule and a job that involves constant novelty and movement, they might function beautifully without medication. That same person in a cubicle job with rigid deadlines and repetitive tasks would be struggling enormously. The ADHD didn't change. The environment did.
Which is actually an empowering reframe. It means treatment isn't just about medication. It's about intentional life design. But it also means the outgrowing narrative is misleading, because it attributes to internal change what's actually a person, environment fit.
And this connects to something Daniel alluded to in his prompt, the calendar management, the time blindness. These are challenges that are fundamentally about the mismatch between how the ADHD brain processes time and how modern adult life is structured. The ADHD brain tends to be very present focused. The future isn't salient in the same way. Deadlines don't feel real until they're imminent. That's not a maturity issue. It's a neurological one. And it doesn't go away just because you've had more birthdays.
What should adult focus support look like if the parent focus model is missing the mark?
I think there are a few things. One is just acknowledging the emotional component, the shame, the grief, the identity reconstruction that comes with late diagnosis. A lot of adults with ADHD have internalized really harsh narratives about themselves, and those don't evaporate the moment you get a diagnosis. Communities that make space for that processing are doing something different from communities that are focused on behavior charts and teacher conferences.
There's also the practical dimension. The strategies that work for a child. Sticker charts, daily report cards, parental supervision. Don't translate to adult life. Adults need strategies for managing finances, for maintaining relationships, for navigating workplace dynamics, for parenting their own kids. It's a completely different toolkit.
On the parenting front, there's a really specific need that I think is underserved. Adults with ADHD who are parenting children with ADHD, which is very common given the high heritability, are in a uniquely challenging position. They're trying to teach executive function skills that they themselves struggle with. They're managing their child's IEP meetings while dealing with their own time blindness and disorganization. That's a specific kind of support that neither general parenting communities nor general ADHD communities tend to address well.
The heritability point is worth underlining. What are the numbers on that?
The heritability of ADH. HD is estimated at around 70 to 80%, which puts it among the most heritable psychiatric conditions. If a parent has ADHD, their child has something like a 50% chance of having it too. Siblings of a child with ADHD have about a 30 to 40% chance. It runs very strongly in families.
When you have an adult with ADHD joining a community, there's a decent chance they're also a parent of a child with ADHD, or they're starting to recognize symptoms in their kid, or they're looking back at their own childhood and seeing their parents through a new lens. It's intergenerational in a really concrete way.
That intergenerational dimension is almost never the starting assumption in these communities. The starting assumption is, I'm a neurotypical parent trying to help my neurodivergent child, when the reality is often, I'm a neurodivergent parent trying to help my neurodivergent child while also figuring out my own neurodivergence. Very different conversation.
Let's talk about the online community dynamic specifically, because Daniel's prompt is about what he's observing in these spaces. I think there's something about the structure of online forums that amplifies the parent voice. Parents of newly diagnosed kids are in crisis mode. They're posting urgently. They're scared. They're looking for immediate answers. Adults with ADHD, who've been managing it for years or decades, might be in a more stable place, or they might be lurking rather than posting. The vocal minority shapes the culture.
That's a really sharp observation. Crisis drives engagement. And a parent who just got a diagnosis for their 7-year-old is often in crisis. An adult who's been living with ADHD for 40 years might have valuable wisdom to share, but they're less likely to be starting new threads at 2 in the morning. So the front page of the community fills up with parent posts, which signals to new arrivals that this is a parent space, which means adults with ADHD are less likely to stick around and contribute, which further entrenches the parent focus. It's a feedback loop.
The moderators and community norms develop around that parent focus. The sticky posts are about school accommodations and medication titration for children. The vocabulary of the community assumes a parent-child dyad. It's not malicious, but it's exclusionary.
There's also a generational element. The adults who are now in their 30s and 40s and getting diagnosed grew up in an era when ADHD awareness was much lower, especially for the inattentive presentation. The hyperactive kid got flagged. The daydreamer who was quietly failing didn't. So there's this whole cohort of adults who are discovering their ADHD later in life, and they're entering communities that weren't built for them.
Which means Daniel's experience is not just common. It's probably the majority experience for adults with ADHD who seek out community support. He's not an edge case. He's the norm that the community structure hasn't caught up to.
That's really the core answer to his question. The data shows unequivocally that ADHD is not a children's condition. It's a lifespan condition that manifests differently at different developmental stages. The majority of children diagnosed with ADHD will continue to have clinically significant symptoms as adults. The framing of ADHD as something you outgrow is not supported by the evidence and has real negative consequences for treatment continuity and self-concept. The parent-focused culture in many support communities reflects historical diagnostic biases, not current scientific understanding.
If Daniel were to find or build an adult-focused ADHD community, what should it center?
I think it should center the lived experience of executive dysfunction in adult contexts. Not, how do I get my kid to do homework, but how do I manage a project with a deadline 3 months from now when my brain only responds to deadlines that are 3 hours from now? Not, what's a good reward system for a 10-year-old? But how do I explain to my spouse that my forgetting things isn't a sign that I don't care? The emotional processing piece. The career navigation piece. The parenting from a place of shared neurodivergence piece.
I think it should also push back against the outgrowing. It narrative explicitly, not in a confrontational way, but by simply being visible, by existing as a space where adults with ADHD are the default, not the exception. Where the assumption is that ADH, D persists, and the question is how to live well with it, not when it will end.
The visibility point matters a lot. One of the most powerful things about finding an adult ADHD community is realizing you're not alone, that the thing you thought was a personal failing is actually a shared neurological reality. That other people have the exact same struggle with the exact same specific absurd situations. The pile of unopened mail, the registration renewal that's 6 months late, the project you started with intense enthusiasm and then completely abandoned. There's something deeply therapeutic about just hearing someone else describe your internal experience.
That's harder to get in a parent-focused space, because the parent is describing their child's behavior from the outside. They're saying, my son forgets his lunchbox every day. They're not saying, I know I need to pack the lunchbox. I'm standing in the kitchen looking at the lunchbox, and somehow my hand won't reach for the lunchbox, and I hate myself for it. The interior experience is what adult A. DHD communities can offer that parent communities typically don't.
That's beautifully put. The interior experience. And that's really what Daniel is missing when he's in those spaces. The reflection of his own interior experience. He's hearing parents talk about their children as subjects to be managed, not as minds to be understood from the inside.
To bring this back to the data one more time, if someone listening is in Daniel's position, an adult with ADHD, who's been told explicitly or implicitly that this is a kid thing they should have outgrown? What's the single most important thing the research tells them?
That their experience is the norm, not the exception. That the majority of people with childhood ADHD remain significantly affected as adults. That the brain differences are real, measurable, and persistent. And that the idea of outgrowing ADHD is a cultural myth that has more to do with how we've historically defined and measured the condition than with what actually happens in people's lives. If you're an adult with ADHD, you're not a failed child case. You're a typical case.
I think that's the line Daniel needed to hear, and probably a lot of other people too.
The flip side of that coin, if you're a parent of a child with ADHD, the data suggests you should be planning for a lifespan condition, not a phase. That doesn't mean being pessimistic. It means being realistic about building skills and supports that will serve your child into adulthood, rather than assuming everything will resolve at 18.
Which actually makes the parent-focused communities and the adult-focused communities natural allies, not separate tribes. The parents need to hear from adults about what actually helps long-term. The adults need to hear from parents about early intervention and what's changed in diagnosis and treatment. The ideal community would have both perspectives in conversation, not siloed.
I completely agree. And there are some spaces that do this well, but the default, as Daniel observed, is still heavily tilted toward the parent perspective. Changing that requires intentional effort, community norms that welcome adult voices, pinned resources for late-diagnosed adults, moderators who understand that ADHD is a lifespan condition. It's not going to self-correct.
I think we've given Daniel a pretty thorough answer. The data is clear. The children's condition framing is wrong. The parent-focused community culture reflects history, not science. And if you're an adult with ADHD, looking for support, you're not looking for the wrong thing. The spaces just haven't caught up to the reality yet.
That sums it up. And I'll add, Daniel, if you're listening, the fact that you think about ADHD in purely adult terms isn't a limitation. It's accurate. That's what ADHD is for most people who have it. A lifespan reality.
By the way, quick note. Today's episode is being scripted by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which is handling all this neuroscience and community dynamics surprisingly well for a language model.
It's doing a solid job. I'm impressed with the nuance.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, a mineralogist on the shores of Lake Tanganyika discovered that certain local specimens of hackmanite, a variety of sodalite, exhibited tenebrescence. They changed color when exposed to sunlight and then faded back in the dark, a property he initially mistook for a sign the rocks were somehow alive.
Right.
Rocks that sunburn and then recover.
Here's what I'm left thinking about. The persistence data on ADHD is strong, but the cultural narrative is stubborn. And the cultural narrative matters, because it shapes who gets diagnosed, who gets treated, who feels entitled to seek support, and how those support systems are designed. Changing the data doesn't automatically change the culture. That takes people like Daniel showing up and saying, hey, I'm here too, and I'm not going anywhere.
That's the forward-looking piece, isn't it? As more adults get diagnosed, and the trends suggest that's exactly what's happening. The community composition is going to shift whether the old guard likes it or not. The question is whether existing spaces adapt or whether new ones get built.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for wrangling everything behind the scenes, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com for every episode, show notes, and the full archive.
If you've got thoughts on this one, especially if you're an adult with ADH, de-navigating these spaces, drop us a review. We read them.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.